it's sort of sad that most of us have not been completely perfected in love, and therefore, from time to time, fear still reigns. We may fear things that go bump in the night, or empty houses, or public speaking. I was so proud of all those who were baptized last Sunday. They spoke. It's a terrifying thing to get up in front of a group of people. I hate public speaking. I always have. I have got my share of phobias. I won't tell you all of them. Over the years, had great fear of certain phone calls I've had to make or certain visits I've had to have where the tension rises, and I dread those. You may have your share of phobias, too, and some of them may be dread things that nobody else knows about, and others may be kind of shared fear of things on the national or the international scene. And throughout the month of February, we are going to be focusing on how to build faith at home, fusing faith and family. Makes sense that we would do that on a Sunday morning. I mean, if the church is nothing else, it is family friendly. We want to cheer families on. So why am I so scared? Over the time that I have served as a pastor, I have never brought a series of messages like the one I'm beginning today. Now, from time to time, I've spoken about home issues and family life and things like that. But I've never brought a series of messages about the family. I've been afraid to. Still afraid to. Now, it's not that I'm not drawn to the topic. I was raised in a family, as were many of you. Mom and a dad and a twin sister. It was a good home. Since leaving home, I have analyzed my home and family of origins, and I've come to understand some of what was pathological and some of what was good and wholesome. Kathy and I have raised a family. We had our children in the home with us for about 25 years. Loved every season those years brought. And now Ben, Zach, and Aaron are on their own. And if they haven't already, they will soon analyze their family of origin. And they will recognize what was pathological, and hopefully we'll see some of what's wholesome, what was good. Kathy and I enjoyed our life before the kids came along. We're enjoying the empty nest now. So I love my family. I love families. So why am I so scared? Well, I'm afraid of giving light answers to weighty questions. I'm afraid of providing simplistic solutions to complex challenges. And the challenges that families face today are incredibly complex. If you and the people in your home are facing challenges, you don't need me providing you with some quick, simple fix as if it was easy. You're smarter than that. Now, I desperately hope that in our 4 weeks together talking about faith-family fusion, I'll say something helpful. Certainly, every time I read a verse in the Bible, that will be helpful. But if I provide you with pat answers, I will not have served you well. I would fear that. I fear that you will hear in what I'm saying that there is some sort of a formula out there which, if we follow, will guarantee a God-honoring home. It's not hard to find a seminar that will tell us what a family is, complete with notebooks on how to run a home according to the Bible. And I'm not going to be cynical. I'm not disparaging. Some of these seminars and books are just wonderful and really, really helpful. What I find intriguing, though, is that there is precious little material in the Bible that is written about the family in the way that we would have written it had we written the Bible. There's certainly instruction of the Bible about how husbands and wives should be with each other and about how parents and children should be with each other. But there are no lists. Not one. I can't take you to a single passage of the Bible where it says these are the six things to do to be a godly husband. I've looked a lot. Or these are the eight steps to being the kind of brother or kind of sister you should be. What the Bible does provide us with is mystery and complexity and nuance and lots and lots of stories, many of them with very, very interesting endings. As important as we all here believe the family is, the Bible's instructions about family comes in a format that just kind of mocks our interest in nice, neat, detailed outlines. I also fear that you'll walk away with the idea that certain behaviors on your part will guarantee certain behavioral responses on the part of the people you live with. If I do X, she will do Y. If I do this, he will do that. If we do this, they will do that. I don't believe the Bible gives that kind of a guarantee. And I want you to know that up front. Now, there are wise ways to carry on at home, and there are unwise ways to carry on at home. And we should, at all times, carry on at home in a wise way. And if we do that, there'll be a greater likelihood that peace and joy and love under God will reign in our home. But every person in your home and every person in my home is a free will agent who will make up his or her mind as to whether or not to submit to the Lordship of Jesus. If we believe that by our example or by our forcefulness or by our love or by our prayers we can guarantee an outcome, I think we've climbed out on a limb without very much biblical support. Those are just a few of my favorite fears. And I could go on, but that would make for a different kind of sermon again. So given that I'm afraid, why deliver this message and why deliver this series? Well, there's a couple of streams that came together, actually three streams. One was a recommendation from Guillermo Cardona and Judy Blake, our children's ministry leader, that we have a month devoted to family. Great suggestion, Guillermo. Thanks, brother. Appreciate that. Another was a series of challenging conversations among the elders where we started to realize, man, there are challenges facing families in homes at our church, certainly in the broader culture, that need to be addressed. And the final tipping point was my own sense that it was time. It's just time. The age in which you and I live has not been kind to families. About as many marriages will break up as will make it. And that's been true for the last several decades in America. Parents face increasing challenges seemingly every month. There's advancing technologies, social networking, there's texting, sexting, the ever-present internet. I mean, gosh, parents, it's a jungle out there. Young adults, which is my word for teenagers, face exactly the same pressures that I faced when I was their age, but they faced them about 5 to 7 to 10 years before I did. George Barna, the researcher, the demographer, tells us that we in America have the assignment to win back an entire generation of children because they have not been exposed to our faith. 7% of those born, 7% of those born post 2000 go to church. That's a staggering statistic, so it's time. I'm not angry. You're not going to hear a rant. But there is a sense of urgency about this series. There's fires burning in homes. Homes that make up our church, certainly in people's homes who aren't in church. And if we can help put out some of those fires or help supply some biblical asbestos so that the fires don't get started, that's a good thing. So today we're starting our series. Guillermo came up with the title for the series, Faith Family Fusion. Great title. All I had to do was come up with a sermon title. So I toyed with a few. I thought about calling this Focus on the Family. Or family life today. That kind of rings true. Decided against those. Then I toyed with this one. How about a grace-based home life? Or growing a family God's way? Guillermo advised against that one. So instead, I've decided to call this sermon, much more original, Building Faith at Home. And no, I've never, ever had an original thought. What I do want to do over these weeks is tell you what I've been convinced of from the Bible about building faith at home. I will run away as fast as I can from any cliche or any canned answer I can. Where it seems appropriate, where it might be helpful, I'll share from my own experience. I have a wealth of experience in how not to and in mistakes. Preachers never have bad experiences, just good sermon illustrations, and I'll share some of those. And together during the month of February, it is my hope and prayer that all of us will find some help from the Bible towards moving in the direction we all want to go, a home that pleases God. One Sunday, I'm going to address husbands and wives, what it might look like to have a marriage where Jesus is Lord. I think I'll call that one love and respect. Another Sunday, I'm going to talk to young adults and their parents, and I'll speak to both equally. Another will be addressed more towards children and the parents who raise them. So on three of the Sundays, the three following this one, I'm going to be sort of having certain people in my bullseye, but others will, everybody else is going to be on the radar. This morning, everybody is in the bullseye. No exceptions. Today, I want to speak about the beauty and the importance of having a home where Jesus is Lord. And everybody is living in a home. You may live in a several thousand square foot home, or you may live in an efficiency apartment. You may live in a townhome or on acreage. But what I have to talk about this morning applies to everybody. Some of you live alone. For a variety of reasons, you may be a single, just starting out in life. You may be middle-aged. You may be elderly. You may like the fact that you're on your own, and you may not. Some of you are part of a nuclear family. I even said it right. You've got a mom and a dad and kids at home and two dogs in the yard, and it's great. And some of you have the incredible responsibility of parenting without a partner, without a spouse. You're a single parent. Some of you are in blended homes where children from former marriages are a part of where you are in your home. Some are married without children. That's not children yet, not children by choice, not children because they're gone. Some have roommates. You live with friends and not family by blood or vow. In every one of our homes, Jesus Christ wants to reign. Having a home where Jesus reigns is every Christian's dream, and it's his dream too. He wants to have a say in every conversation that is held in your home. He wants conversations to reflect his heart, both among the people who are living in the home and with visitors and guests who stop by. He wants the full range of emotions expressed in your home, joy, weeping, everything, with authenticity. He said that he came to provide abundant life for us. And I think that has a lot to do with experiencing all the emotions that he's given us. He wants his word to be read and revered and obeyed. He doesn't want to be ignored. He wants to be talked to. He wants our homes to be havens of safety, bastions of strength, and hospitals where there's healing. And if that sounds good to you, it sounds really good to me. But it may be that for you, like me, certain times and at certain levels, that's not exactly what our homes look like, and it may be for a number of reasons. On the one hand, it may be that you are committed to the Lordship of Jesus Christ and others in your home or not. And every time you try to enthrone Jesus at home, it seems like you're swimming upstream. And you're tired. Or you may be new to the faith. And you hear all this about having a home where Jesus is Lord, and it sounds good, but what do you do? What do I? Okay, I'm not sure what that would even look like. I'm getting the church stuff. You know, I know when to stand up and when to sit down, but what would I do at church, at home? Or maybe that you're having challenges enthroning Jesus at home because of bad habits you've developed. And the bad habits could look like anything. Jesus wants you to have complete victory over the bad habits you have, whether it has to do with substance abuse or whether it has to do with bad language or inappropriate use of the internet. He wants victory so that we can enjoy his reign in our lives. It's possible that one of the reasons you're having a difficult time enthroning Jesus is that you are a Christian and you've been living for quite a while without intentionality to enthrone Jesus. And you're battling entropy. It's just kind of comfortable the way it is, and so it's hard to change. Vision is to have a home where Jesus Christ reigns supreme. And for all of us, there's some distance between that vision and reality. Some of us, it may look like for you, that's just around the corner, almost there. And for others, it may look like it's a Grand Canyon leap. And while we're thinking about, man, if I could just get there, if we as a family could just get there, the thought may come to your mind, if my wife would just, or if my husband would just be a little bit more, then we could have a God-honoring home where Jesus is Lord. Maybe thinking about your roommate and how difficult it is to have the home you want while your roommate's there. Doesn't every parent understand that if their children were just like this, it'd be so much easier? Every child recognizes that if their parents are just like, if they were just like this, it'd be so much easier. And herein lies the challenge that results whenever we think about having a home where Jesus is Lord. It is not a decision that any of us individually can unilaterally make. We're forced to admit that in the things that matter most to us in life, we are least in control. Decisions to have a home where Jesus is Lord are made by individuals who occupy that home. So the first step in having a home where Jesus is Lord is to make sure that my heart is a place where Jesus is Lord. And fortunately for all of us this morning, there is a passage in the Bible that gives us a picture of what a Jesus is Lord life looks like. It's been called the greatest sermon ever preached, and it's found in Matthew's Gospel, Matthew chapter 5 through 7. The sermon was directed at disciples, but there were multitudes of others who heard it. About 20 years ago, I attended a seminar on preaching. Believe it or not, I did, really. Chuck Swindoll gave a 30-minute message on the Sermon on the Mount. It was amazing. One of the best sermons I've ever heard about the greatest sermon ever given. And I know what you're thinking. Dave, I've heard Chuck Swindoll. You're not Chuck Swindoll. So relax. I'm not going to try anything as bold as preaching the Sermon on the Mount. All I want to do is demonstrate from the Sermon on the Mount what it might look like if Jesus was Lord of our lives. I want you to consider what I'm going to do in the following 3 or 4 minutes, sort of a Reader's Digest paraphrase of the Sermon on the Mount. And if you want to just pretend right now that Jesus is walking up to the pulpit, he might say something like this if he came to our 9:30 worship service. If you're looking for happiness and fulfillment in life, obey God. That's where satisfaction's found. Admit that you are spiritually bankrupt. You have nothing but need to bring to God. And obey him. Learn mercy, make peace, even when people do you dirty. Rejoice when you have to swim upstream to live for me. Godly people have been doing that for thousands of years. Never forget that you are my ambassadors in the world, so be world changers. Let your light shine. Be salty for God. I'm calling you to raise the bar when it comes to leading an exemplary life. If you are suffering a fractured relationship, don't wait for the other person to come to you. You go to them and initiate a reconciliation. Do everything you can to eliminate from your life any taint of sin. Always keep your promises. Be a person of your word, especially when it comes to marriage. If you're married, stay married. It's a sacred vow. People will sometimes wrong you. Expect it. Learn the grace of forgiveness. Blow people away with your forgiving spirit. Do the unexpected. Don't just forgive friends. Forgive those who have set themselves against you. Now, I think Jesus might pause right about then. Catch his own breath. Let all of that sink in for us. So we're thinking. And then very quickly, he would relaunch and reload. You are to be all about God. Show how all about God you are by your outrageous and secret generosity, by your fervent prayer life, by non-showy fasting. Where your financial treasure is, your heart will follow. So make weighty financial investments in the eternal kingdom, even to the detriment of your 401k. In everything you do, be wholly devoted to God. And look at the flowers. Watch the birds. They're beautiful and cared for. And God cares for you so much more than he does flowers and birds. Don't worry. Be happy. Anyone with an ounce of observation skills will see shortcomings in others. The gift of seeing others' faults is cheap and easy to cultivate. More difficult and much more valuable is the art of seeing your own faults and working on them. So look to the mirror before you look out the window. Never doubt that God is really, really good. If you ask him for something, he's not going to give you something hurtful. Every gift God gives is for your good. And whenever you're confused about how to treat somebody in your life, here's a golden thought. Treat them exactly the way you would like to be treated if you were in the same situation. You'll hear all kinds of siren voices telling you that this way or that way or this other way is the way to life. Trust me on this. I know what I'm talking about. The way to life is to trust me. Never think for one moment that getting in good with God is about what you do or how good you are. It's not about calling me Lord. It's not about doing good works. It's about doing the will of my Father who is in heaven. And what is the will of my Father who is in heaven? It is to trust me. And at the end of that, like the multitudes are heard him the first time, we would say, wow. And we would sit back and just imagine, what if my life was built on that? Wouldn't it be the life I've always wanted? And what if my home and everybody who lives in my home with me was on the same page and we all wanted to live like that? Wouldn't that be the home we've always wanted to live in? That's what it means to live with Jesus enthroned. Not just to hear it, but to do it. And the last words of Jesus lead us to application. I'm going to read Matthew 7, verse 24 and following. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house, and yet it did not fall, for it had been founded on the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. Some things are just too easy, like shooting fish in a barrel. It's almost like Jesus was reading the San Antonio Express News or watching the 10 o'clock news. And we here in San Antonio had just recently seen the damage that results when the foundation is not laid well. Homes suffer cracked slabs. Isn't that awful? And retaining walls topple. And none of us want that to happen to our homes, either physically or spiritually. And Jesus alone provides a solid foundation for a life. I'm going to suggest two ways that any of us here might apply what Jesus has to say. First, Jesus calls us to faith. Read the Sermon on the Mount reflectively, honestly, and you see that he set the bar so high, there's no realistic way any of us are ever going to make it. There just is no way. And if that's what you're thinking, you're thinking right, because part of the purpose of giving the Sermon on the Mount was to show that and to prove that anybody who's trying to work their way to God is doomed to failure. You can't make it. I'll just ask, are you encouraged to continue to try to work your way to God by these words? Therefore, you're to be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. I'm not encouraged to keep on trying to get to God by works when I read that. So what we are encouraged to do when we listen to the Sermon on the Mount is to say, forget it. I'm abandoning the way of works, and I'm going to look for another way to get to God, and that is the way of faith. Eternal salvation is a gift of God's grace and is given at the instant we stop trying to work our way to Him and turn to Him in faith and put our trust in Him. That's when life starts. And you may have been coming to a church for a long, long time. This may be the first time you've been to this church. Maybe the first time in a long time you've thought about this kind of stuff. And maybe up to this point you've been trying so hard, every way you can think of, to get to God on your own. And the best news you could ever hear today is this: you'll never make it. I'll never make it. You'll never make it. Nobody makes it that way. We're not good enough. That's why Jesus died on the cross, to rescue us from ourselves when we could never make it on our own. And today can be the day that you place the treasure of your trust in a Jesus who loves you desperately, loves you so much he died on the cross for you. And when you put your faith in him, that instant you become a child of God. And at that instant, you establish a foundation for life that will not crumble when the storms come. But if the Sermon on the Mount is a call to faith, it is also a call to faithfulness. Jesus is a king. And those of us who have placed our trust in this king have become a part of his kingdom. What we've seen today is sort of a blueprint for life lived in obedience to King Jesus. And we don't submit to his lordship so that we will go to heaven, so that we will get saved. We submit to his lordship because we are saved. It makes all the difference in the world. The Sermon on the Mount describes a life under the rule of King Jesus. And we want the world to see that we joyfully, enthusiastically live life under his lordship. And it is an awesome, wonderful thing. It is a dream. It is a vision worth giving our lives to when a family, people living in the same home, join hands and hearts to submit to the lordship of Jesus together. When there is that going on, there is not a more winsome, appealing, attractive witness in the world than a home where Jesus is Lord. And it all starts when you make our hearts a place where Jesus is Lord.